All right. Welcome to Planning Commission tonight. Any public comments? No public comments this evening. We will move into agenda item 3, work session, and Sherry.
This is some exciting stuff for you. All right, so we are on chapter 8, which is the general requirements. Essentially, it's the subdivision design or section. So it's got a lot of exciting stuff in it for you. So the first section, section 10, is the general standards. So it has some things in there that are just general statements about ownership, landscaping, fencing, all those things that I've listed there. I won't bother to read all of those things off. And then in the next section, on section 20, it goes into subdivision layout and talks about the conformance to the general plan for infrastructure and active transportation. So if we have something on our active transportation that says we're supposed to have a bike path or something through this piece of property, then when it comes in for a subdivision, they would need to dedicate that and put it on their plan. Or if they have, we have a plan to have it widened, then they would have to be widened the road in front of the development. It also has some language about preservation of the natural environment, trying to save as many trees as possible and waterways, and then join up with adjoining streets. So the exciting parts start getting in when you get into section 30, where we talk about lots. So this is there's some existing language in there from our subdivision chapter in 10.7.7, but that a lot of it's been updated, or there's some new stuff in there, and just kind of looking at how these things have been practiced. So one of the statements that our code say is that new lots should be buildable. They should not be impractical due to slope, shape, or shape. The lot can't be divided by the city or county line, so you can't have a lot in a subdivision that's half in Bountiful and half in North Salt Lake. It has to be entirely within North Salt Lake. Wedge lots, so lots that are not square, wedge lots are lots that would be on a cul-de-sac, have to meet the minimum frontage for the zone. There's some standards for how the side lot lines go perpendicular to the street. Obviously, there's a requirement for frontage on a public or a private street. I think we've added the language in there for private street just so that is clear, that it can be a public street or a private street. We prohibit frontage on double frontage on lots unless there are topographical constraints. One of the things it says about lots is corner lots have to have an equivalent building area to other lots in the subdivision. So a corner lot, because it has two street frontages, it has two front setbacks, and so the lots usually need to be a little bit bigger in order to still be buildable. But the big changes in here come for the definition of slopes of lot. So in our current code, we have a definition for unrestricted lots, and it says a lot has to have 5,000 square feet of buildable area that's less than 30% in slope with a minimum width of 50 feet. So as I was thinking about this when I was updating this code, I was like, well, how big of a lot would I have and still meet the setbacks? And it would take a 12,000 square foot lot with the front and rear setbacks of 25 feet and the two side setbacks 10 feet each. In order to get a 5,000 square foot building envelope, which means our lots that have 5,000 square feet total don't have 5,000 square feet of buildable area because excluding the setbacks. So I figured we needed to tighten up that language. And so what I'm suggesting we put in there is that obviously the average has to be less than 30%. There can't be any 30% in the building envelope. If the lot is less than 12,000 square feet, they can't have any area of 30% slope. And then the buildable area for lots over 12,000 square feet, they have to have that minimum 5,000 square feet that we have in the code right now. So I've done this little math, very square parcel up there, so you can kind of see how that works out. And then there's a requirement for no remnant parcels. All land should be in a lot, so when you do a subdivision, they shouldn't leave any extra land outside the subdivision. The little picture that you see there at the lower right on the screen is an example of a remnant lot, which is a very troublesome lot for us. It is on Lofty Lane, and people think it's a buildable lot because it was supposed to be something that the South Davis Water owned, and they were supposed to put a water tank on it, and then they decided they didn't need a water tank there, and then they sold it. And it's been sold from one owner to the next owner to the next owner. So every few years we have somebody come in who has a plan that they want to build on that. Well, the essentially is the flag lot. The stem of the flag or the staff is too long. It's downsloped. They can't get a driveway that's less than 10% into it. They can't get sewer back up to the road because of the slope. It's a very difficult lot for somebody to figure out how to build it, or a very expensive lot, let's put it that way. So that's why we don't want remnant lots. Then put some guidelines in there for lot numbering and numbering by phasing so that they're easy to tell. When somebody gives us a lot number for building permit, we know which phase it's in. So I wanted to show you a couple of things associated with that just to give you some examples. The picture that you have on the right there, these are two lots. They're combined by tax number for one, they're owned by one parcel. So this is a 0.61 acre lot. That's 26,000 square feet. When I look at these lots, I get really worried that someday somebody's gonna come into the office and want to build on this lot. These are subdivided lots. So they're in a recorded subdivision. I don't know why they got approved, but it wasn't you guys. It was 30, 40 years ago. And on paper, they looked flat. But at the sidewalk, the elevation is 4745. As you move down the slope, and you can kind of see it in the picture on the right, it's a little bit better for the how that lot falls right off. But it drops 66 feet from the front of the property to the back of the property, over 200 feet in length. So it's a slope of 33%. I have no idea how these lots will ever be built upon. So we want to avoid that in the future, and that's why we have the requirements for those slope restrictions. The next section that I'd like to talk about with you and like to have a discussion about is flag lots. As I was reorganizing the code, we have a provision for flag lots. Currently, the code says that flag lots cannot be created in an existing subdivision. So if a subdivision was ever filed, nobody can ever re-subdivide that lot. I wanted to give you this example. Here are two lots, excuse me, that I'm pointing to in this. One of them is in a subdivision and one of them is not in a subdivision. They are half acre lots in a quarter acre zone, or in a 7,000 square foot lot zone. So these are in the R17 and they are half acre in size. They're underutilized, but the one property owner, because it's a meets and bounds description and nobody filed a subdivision plat 50 years ago when they divided the lots and got their permits in the county, they could have us, they could divide it and put another lot, but these other folks couldn't do that on that one. So I wanted to have a conversation with the Planning Commission to see if that's really something that we want to continue to have in the ordinance, is that provision that they cannot re-subdivide a lot. So one of the other things that the existing language has for flag lots is that the staff of the flag lot has to be 30 feet in width and it has to have a 20-foot drive. If you put two flag lots next to each other, they can be reduced each to 25 feet, so there's a total of 50 feet, and have this and have a shared drive of 20 feet. So that leaves 30 feet of landscaping on both sides of the driveway coming into a flag lot. Now 50 feet is the total right-of-way of a public local street. So at this point, they might as well build a street if they have to set aside 50 feet of right-of-way. So I wanted to give you an example here on the screen. There's a particular property that, in fact, Mackenzie and I spoke to them the other day, and some of you who may have been, I don't know if any of you were on the Planning Commission 6 years ago, but we had a subdivision approved there for a PUD that was called Romaine Court, and they were doing some townhomes. And then they got it all approved, and they sold it, and the person they sold it to didn't ever record the subdivision. So he came in and visited with us this week, and we said, sorry, the code is now changed. You'll never get 8 units on it, because 8 townhome units, because you have to take out the road, and now it's on net density. But how could you divide it, and sell it other ways? So I was looking at this. So this is kind of a good example of what could be done on this property. It's an acre in size. The first drawing shows 2 7,000 square foot lots along Main Street. Their minimum width is 60 feet in that zone. And then 2 flag lots, and I've drawn them here with 15 foot staffs, so a total of 30 feet if you were to consider that as an ordinance change. That would be how this could be drawn. Those 2 lots that are flag lots in the back are 13,000 and 12,000 square foot lots. This is one way it could be developed. As we looked at other options on this, I thought, okay, what would happen if they wanted to do a standard subdivision in the R17 zone and build a road, a private street down there with a cul-de-sac? They could do it as a PUD. And those lots on that, the 2 lots out on the street are 7,000 square feet. In the first drawing, the 2 lots out on the street are about 8,000 square feet, and then the other are 12 and 13. In the middle drawing, this shows 4 lots, so 7,000 square feet out on the street, and then 2 smaller lots, and I can't remember what the dimensions are, but that would be a way to build a public street. So that's really not ideal. I don't think our public works would like to go and plow a short dead-end street that's 118 feet with a cul-de-sac. But they could ask for that as a subdivision because it would meet the minimum standards of the code. The other alternative would be, instead of building a street with a cul-de-sac, they could build a hammerhead, in which case they could then get 5 lots that have 7,000 square feet minimum. So I just wanted to show you that they are alternative options for development on this particular piece, and have a conversation about whether a flag lot would be more ideal, or would the standard subdivision with a public street or a private street. So what I would like to discuss with you are some proposals to remove the restriction first on the already subdivided lots. I think that is a missing middle housing or affordability issue. A lot of people that own these bigger lots have a lot to maintain. It's very costly for them. It might help them stay in their homes if they can divide it and have another lot. A lot of their property is underutilized, and if it were to be allowed to be divided, they could have reduced lawn or outdoor water use. If you look at these 3 pictures that I have here on this screen, I wanted to identify some of the other flag lots that we have in the city. So I can't read what streets the 2 on the right are on, but the one on the upper right shows you 2 lots that are flag lots that I didn't know were there. I just went on Google Earth and started zooming around and seeing where I could find some lots. I don't have any complaints. I haven't received any about these flag lots. They don't seem to be intrusive to the other neighborhood. The one on the lower left is off of Odell Lane. And then the one on the lower right is a combination of 2 flag lots that they put together with the 25-foot staffs, and they built 1 house. So that's just an example of the flag lots. And just to give you some reference on what the setbacks and requirements are on flag lots. You can see I've done that diagram that shows what the staff is and how right now it's defined the front, where the front and the rear property lines are. So discussing setbacks on that, currently our code requires the same front and rear setbacks, and then but perhaps we might want to reduce those setbacks, or we may want to look at allowing the Planning Commission to determine which property line is actually the front property line and which ones are the side property lines. And I'll show you another drawing here that I wanted to show you. Did I not put the other? I must have missed that one. Oh, I was going to show you one that was off of Odell Lane, or not Odell Lane, 100 South, that is 2 flag lots that they actually share the same flag that's only 16 foot. I thought I put it in here, but I didn't. Anyway, and then the staff width, the single staff again with the 30 feet wide and the 20 foot drive. So maybe we want to allow a shared staff with 30 feet with a shared 20 foot drive. Do you want to comment on that or have a discussion on that?
So I understand, I have no problem with the staff width and shared driveway and all that, but I'm still struggling with trying to essentially for purposes of middle housing and affordability, trying to allow development at the backside of an existing ding. Because I think, in my opinion, you know, two things that I would expect that would really animate the neighbors is, number one, somebody buys a house and puts up a McMansion. And two, somebody puts in something that doesn't fit the character on the back of a lot, and next thing you know, it's looking down on their pool or whatever. I don't know. It just seems like it's an intrusion. But my question is if we're concerned about affordability, don't we already have solutions with accessory dwelling units?
We do. We do have those. But the way that I like to think about affordable housing, or even just the affordability of housing, not necessarily for low income. We're not talking about people. I mean, when you do these subdivisions, they're going to be a building lot. They're not going to be, not going to meet the 80% AMI. This is going to be people who meet 100% or more of AMI. So it's really that gap that we're missing. But as far as affordability goes, there's not one solution. So not everybody wants to have a accessory dwelling unit that they have to maintain or be a landlord for. It's kind of a piece of, there are many pieces, and all of the pieces go together can affect something. So while the affordability, this isn't going to solve the affordability process problem for everyone, it's somewhat solves it for those people. I mean, for a few people. I'm not hanging my hat on that. I'm just saying that could be a reason that we might want to consider.
When you buy a proper new subdivision, though, aren't you kind of buying into the whole notion that this is how it's configured and this is how it is? And I mean, that's one of the reasons I think it's there, because all of a sudden it becomes a bait and switch, you know. So like, you know, you've seen this. I mean, I can think of places that would really perturb me wanting to live where I was, if, you know, some of the scenic easements and things like that were developed. You buy it, you have knowledge that there are these are things that you like and you're used to, and I think I just have some reservations. It seems like when you buy that subdivision, you're kind of getting it. Now, I'm not, I wouldn't be opposed to it, but I would think that you would need to go to your adjoining landowners and get some kind of consent agreement and have them say, we have no objection.
I don't think we can put something in place that says they have to ask their permission from their neighbors, because that wouldn't provide for equal treatment under the law. And so, but there are things that we could put on as far as restrictions. We could put height restrictions on that. We can put, I can't put architectural restrictions on it because we can't put architectural restrictions on single family homes. But that we can limit the height. So in the ordinance right now, it says you can't have like decks and stuff overlooking the person's backyard. Can you pull up Google Earth and go to 100 South? I really wanted to show you this one because it was, and I swear I had a slide for it, so I must have accidentally deleted it, unfortunately. There's a couple of, and it just shows how they oriented the lots differently. Instead of calling that side that we would, under our ordinance, call front, they've called it, or it was built so that it was actually on this side. It's with the setbacks. And I think it made it so that it's less intrusive to the neighborhood. Yeah. So it's on the east end of 100 South where there's a PUD. So go to Odell Lane and then go east of Odell Lane. So right there at the end, you see that cul-de-sac? And coming off of the cul-de-sac, so move it further over. Right there. Right there. So I do? Oh, I had it out of order. That's why. So this is the Osborne Plan Unit Development, where they have two lots here that are sharing the same flag, and they have an easement across them. The easement is only 16 feet wide. Now, how this got approved, I'm not sure, because I don't know if the flag lot ordinance was different then, or if the Planning Commission at the time varied it because it was a PUD. But this is an example when you look at the way that those two homes that are on those flag lots are oriented, rather than orienting the front of them towards the back of the house that sits in front, they turned them sideways and then turned them to their, basically to their driveway that was, is a buffer between them and the backyards of the other homes that are to the south. So these are just some examples of flag lots that we have. I'm not saying or advocating that we necessarily have to do flag lots. If we don't want to have any flag lots at all, we could certainly say that. I'm just saying if we're going to move the flag lot ordinance over and we want to update it to change some of the rules, this would be the time to do it and the time to have that conversation. But this is an example. And like I said, I've never received any complaints in the 8 years I've been here about the functionality of these lots. We can certainly, I can investigate more, see what other cities have done as far as regulations for the homes that get built on flag lots, to see if they have some restrictions that they put in that protect the neighbors from intrusion. But I would argue that the same people over on this slide, these two neighbors both bought into the same neighborhood, and they would have the same expectation that they bought into this neighborhood, and we have big lots, but the one would be entitled to get a flag lot only because nobody had ever filed a subdivision plat because it wasn't required at the time. And the other one is prohibited because having the exact same circumstances, because it's already in a subdivision, they can't re-subdivide it. But we can leave it exactly like it is, or we could take them out.
I don't think the disparity makes sense, but I still have concerns about allowing people to kind of disrupt any given neighborhood by putting something in that many people would have never expected to show up as their neighbor.
Mm-hmm. You want to think about that and we can visit it again?
I agree with Commissioner Jorgensen. And also just how many opportunities are there? And if that...
I could do an analysis of that before we got this back and see how many...
It just seems like it'd be so small that excluding flag lots doesn't seem like an extreme position.
It is not an extreme position. Lots of places do not allow flag lots. So it's not an extreme position. But I'm happy to analyze it further or to just leave it the way it is.
Is anyone opposed to taking it out? Anyone feel like the staff needs to do more work to feel okay about that input? I don't think so either. I think we're okay to, unless anyone else wants to speak to that.
To not allow flag lots at all?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to write that down. Okay, easy enough. All right. I thought you might like that. So this is about the section 50 is about blocks. So this reduces, this is an amendment. The first one is some of the things that we've discussed when we were looking at the form-based code. So that would be reducing the block length minimum from 400 feet to 300 feet. requiring a mid-block pedestrian access for through lots. I wanted to know and ask the question for the Planning Commission, is this really something that we wanted? We don't have any regulations when we do require them, who owns them, who maintains them. If we are going to have them, I would suggest that we, you know, make them have a 16-foot easement with 8 feet of pavement or concrete. So I have a couple examples here. One is the one that's between our chair and her sister's house over on Roxbury Drive. So you can see that I think it's pretty well used, and I think you probably, you know, have more experience and can tell us if it is a nuisance.
Do you know the story of this that just happened like a month ago?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, somebody who was drunk drove their car, parked it down that, and then walked it to my house and told me that they were there for the job. I was not home. My child was babysitting. So we see it on our Ring camera that like somebody's clearly intoxicated coming into the house. We were at Eccles at a show. So we're like calling my son, panicking. He calls us back like 4 minutes later, annoyed. And he's like, of course I called the police first because I knew you were at the show. And I was like, this really impressive management. So my input is
really
this
weird.
Often gets driven down. This
really?
Is not the first time. So this size is just enough to have people feel like maybe it's a road, because I was super impressed that he did not hit either of the fences because he was very drunk, but it's not the first time it gets driven down. So I don't know if it's like make it a little bit smaller or put like something in front of it, like a target ball
or something.
but
who maintains that one?
Who maintains it?
Yeah.
Me and my sister do. But I actually think that the HOA would do it, but it is majorly trafficked with school children because the road just to the west of us is the busiest street. And so I think most parents have had their kids filtered down this road because then they just walk down the center of the road of the circle because there's no cars on it ever.
Right.
And so many school kids come through there that we end up just doing it in the morning before school starts. But I think the HOA technically is in charge of it.
Hmm. Well, I wanted to provide a couple of other places where we have these. So I knew you would have a story about that. I didn't know it would be that exciting. But the other one is this catwalk that goes from, I think it's 200 north up to Highway 89. So it's the end of that cul-de-sac, and it goes between the apartments and the Ponds Plumbing Building. And this one kind of is a bit of a nuisance for our police department and code enforcement because it's so narrow. Nobody ever drives on it, though. It's so narrow that it's hard to be seen in there because of the solid fencing on both sides. When you get a little further up, there's just chain link on this one side. But there's a lot of vandalism and a lot of dumping that goes on in there. Like, I've went out there to visit it once, and there was graffiti all over the fence, and people had dumped mattresses and other junk there. And so this is just a question that I wanted to know. Do we want to still have these? And if we do have them, should we have standards? So now I hadn't really thought about somebody driving down them.
Honestly, I would rather have people driving down it than have it be narrow and have it be like vandalism and dumping stuff.
Right. But we can probably put something in there to address the people driving on it.
Can we just go back to the fundamental question of why? Why do we want them? If the blocks are short enough, you've got access to it. I mean, I've actually used some. Like, there's one at the top of Gary Way. You can pop your bike up this gravel trail, and I don't know if it's really because of this or if it was part of the park system or whatever, but there's times when there's a purpose because it helps you access, like, the Bonneville Shoreline Trail or something from your house, and if there's a purpose and a need, that's great. But just to, you know, arbitrarily say every time we're going to do it, whether we need it or not, I kind of come back to the question of why.
If I could counter, if we're getting personal here, across the street from my house, across the street and then on the back of the houses across the street is a cul-de-sac, and there isn't a formalized walkway into the cul-de-sac, but kids go through the yards constantly because it's such a shortcut. It saves over a quarter mile, and it gets used anyway. And I would think if it was formalized like this that the neighbors would actually like it.
Yeah, and in our down in Foxboro, it's such a walkable area to the school, and so many kids walk out of these cul-de-sacs down there, and so everyone has a passageway, and they get used all the time, just for connectability and walkability down there.
So would this be, so I think that that's one of the things that's maybe missing in our code. It doesn't say this is a mid-block crossing, like if you had a long block, but it doesn't say at the end of a cul-de-sac. And so that isn't addressed in it. So I can look at some language for that and perhaps look at some sort of language for bollards. And I'd like to put something in there about maintenance and who's supposed mm-hmm. to maintain it. My issue is kind of an issue is having like the example of the catwalk is that it's so narrow and the sidewalks are right up there against it that it doesn't feel like a very safe mm-hmm. place to be. It's not a very attractive place to be, and it tends to draw vandals. And so I don't know how your fence does. You have a wider fence, but I don't know if you have kids that kick it. But my thought was if you had the some landscaping on either side of it, that it might keep your fence from getting beat with a baseball bat.
Well, it's also the length, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
The longer the path, the wider it should be to feel.
Yeah, and where this one has a bend in it, so you visually can't see through it, that I also think adds to the alleyway kind of going in there to hide and not feel safe or be seen, where when the vantage is straight through, there isn't as much. We don't have any problem with our fence. We haven't had any like dumping or vandalism or damage to the fence at all.
I think this one is, I mean, it's problematic because it's adjacent between a business and apartments. It's not in a single family neighborhood where you have eyes and ears all the time on your walkway. I mean, I don't think kids would get away with anything if they were going through that you would know about it.
Do you have any idea if it's getting used? Is it there to connect a school area?
There used to be a crosswalk that up to Adelaide.
Okay.
We don't have a crossing there on Highway 89 anymore. The crossings are all moved to the intersections. And I think it's because they rearranged the district's boundaries or the school boundaries.
Yeah. Sure. Did you want to add something?
Yeah. That's in our neighborhood. I can tell you a lot about that one. First of all, there's a problem of the width. It's 4 feet, but the pavement in there is not concrete. It's asphalt, but it breaks off a lot. And so it's really kind of, run down. But it used to be very highly used because all of the neighborhood on that side went up to Orchard. And so it cut off a lot of them, at least a quarter mile, maybe even half a mile of walking. There's also another one over on between 350 and where it comes out there. There's one that goes over towards Adelaide.
And yeah, I incorrectly said Adelaide when I meant Orchard.
Yeah, and so this one, I'm not sure now that where the kids don't go to Orchard School that live in that neighborhood, but I think that if you put something in an ordinance, I would say at least 5 feet wide, and that it must be made out of concrete rather than asphalt, and that the grade can't be dropping off on the side so that it's, falls apart. And I think the fencing ought to be such that it's retaining the children and keeping them from doing whatever. But I think a minimum should be at least 5 feet.
And some kind of sturdy fencing material. So if we want to continue this stuff, I'll look at additional ways that we can make it better to address some of those concerns before I bring the ordinance back for you in the final draft. Any other comments?
I can come back to you. I just think that, it's going to depend. In some places, it's clearly warranted because it may be the logical shortcut to whatever. But in other cases, just in the idealized world, just say everything's 300 by 300 by 300, and this is a gridded system. Do you really need to have shortcuts every which way? I mean, right to the middle of all those blocks?
It depends on how long the dead-end road is, right? So if the dead-end road's 1,000 feet, that might be a condition of them putting in, you know, like say they came in and wanted an exception to go to 1,000 feet, then that might be something that we would look at, or the Planning Commission would look at as it was being approved, that said, hey, well, if you're gonna do this longer block, then you should have this mid-block crossing or crossing or pedestrian access at the end of the cul-de-sac. So I think it's good to have it for an option. I'm not sure it should always be required, but I think that that would be a good take to make it an option, that the Planning Commission could require it under certain circumstances.
I go back to how many instances of this are possible in our current North Salt Lake? Why not be conservative? I love the wider, but stopping cars from driving down it, why not just go conservative? Because I don't know how many times this will actually be feasible in the city limits.
So the only way, like if this one were going to be ever fixed, like if somebody wanted to redevelop either of these two properties on the other side, if we put it in the ordinance that said they would need to widen this, that would be something that we would want to have in an ordinance for the existing ones. There's one on Odell Lane that goes into the back of the school. There's one that goes into the back of Adelaide. The ones that are in Foxborough. I mean, it's rare because we don't have a lot of undeveloped land, so I don't think there's going to be a lot of occasions, but it would be good to have the ordinance in case of redevelopment, and especially in case of redevelopment on Highway 89, where we might want to punch some accesses, pedestrian accesses through from the trail on Highway 89 to the development. Also on Redwood Road, if any of that zoning were to change and you wanted to push some access through, we've done one. We did one next to the Holiday Oil that goes down near between Holiday Oil and the vacant property to the north, but near Spectrum Academy, that gets you through to from the highway to that. So there are some occasions where it might be something that we would want to have the option to do, but I would like to make it an option that we could require it when it seemed like it would make sense. But I think we need to outline what those times would be and how it would be done. So let me do some more research and work on some wording there. And we'll see what we can come up with. Okay. Let's see. So the next section is 60, and it's about streets. This updates the tables with pavement width minimums rather than the curb face width, which is kind of confusing. And then it specifies that private streets, or what I'm suggesting is the private streets, be the same as public streets for single family developments. So I've given two examples here because I like to use my planning commissioner's homes as examples. So in Foxborough, we have the Stonehaven development and Wellington Place, both single family developments, both have narrow streets. That do not meet the minimum 50-foot right-of-way and 27 feet of asphalt is the minimum. But they haven't really been too much of a problem. Now, I won't say that Stonehaven hasn't been a problem with pushing parking onto the street, but it wasn't because of the narrow streets in their subdivision. We found out a few weeks ago the HOA, Dixie from Red Rock HOA, called us. And their HOA wanted to know, if you notice on their street, they have rows and rows of parking that is extra parking that I believe is for overflow parking. Their HOA has been managing that, thinking that those parking spaces could not be used by anyone who lived in the development but had to be reserved for guests. So while all the cars have been parked on 900 North, they've had empty parking spaces along their own private road in the development because they thought they couldn't park in those spaces. So
have they been enforcing that?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And towing their residents who park in it. So that's why those cars were pushed out onto the street, which has then caused us to want to to go out and red curb the whole north side of the street on 900 North because of people trying to pull out of the streets and can't see because of the traffic that's parked there. So I think we're going to see a great improvement in that area along 900 North after we had a little discussion with them. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I don't care if they want to reserve certain spaces in every single section of parking for guests only, but they, their residents can park there too. It's not, it was not ever intended to be guest only because there is a tremendous amount of parking, way over any standard that we have for guest parking, for the amount of guest parking that they have. So, interestingly enough. On the development on the right is the Views, which has narrower streets, has sidewalk only on one side, and it is a private, it is private streets. And they have had problems. And I don't blame all of the problems on the fact that the streets are narrow. Some of them, I believe, are rightfully blamed on the developer who built the roads. But they have issues with snow plowing. That could be some of the steepness of the road. They have issues with where the snow gets put because they don't have shoulders with or park strips to put them on because they're more narrow. And so I wanted to ask the question, do we want to say that single-family developments that want private roads, that those roads should still meet the same minimum standards that a public street meets? The then advantage of only advantage of having a private road then would be because they wanted it to be exclusive and gated, you know, that type of thing. Or perhaps because it was, you know, a long dead-end street or a... topography or a slope issue like we did in Eaglewood Cove. Those streets are full standard width, but they are private streets because of the steepness of the road and the, how high they are up on the hillside and the difficulty for our city snowplows. So there are all sorts of reasons. I just wanted to have a conversation about that. Definitely that this new ordinance does state that they have to be constructed to the same standards. So the same road base thickness, the same asphalt thickness. And I think that might be some of the issues too with the roads and the Views, is that they may not have been built to the same construction standard, not just the same width standard.
They should absolutely be the same. And if anyone disagrees,
I agree. I'm
going to have words.
What's the current minimum width for a private road? I'm just curious. I'm not disagreeing.
Let's see. For the, let me turn to that. So a minor local street, the minimum right-of-way width is 50 feet with a minimum 32 feet of pavement. Now, we have reduced that on many occasions in PUDs or P districts, at least at the minimum asphalt width. So there is a mechanism there, and there still will be a mechanism in place that would be a legislative change. Somebody could ask for an exception to that, and it would go through a process where we get a planning commission recommendation and then go to the city council for final approval of that. So there is a mechanism to still vary those standards or modify those standards, because modifying the standards out in Foxborough area where it's nice and flat might not be a problem, but modifying those standards up on the hillside might be a problem. And so that would be, you know, a reason for us to say, well, we appreciate that you asked for that reduction. We're going to recommend the city council they deny it because you're on the hillside, or we're going to improve it out here because it's flat and there's not as much snow that happens out here and there's not the terrain issues.
Because I'm sure the gutter falls into that street design as well.
Right.
Right. Commissioner Tucker, you might know better than anybody. A 50-year gutter?
Designed to take
so, storm. Yeah, exactly. Why would we have one neighborhood in the city that it doesn't need to take a 50-year storm while the rest of the city needs it? Yeah. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
So is that the consensus that the single family ones should meet the same minimum standard? Okay. All right.
Yes.
I like it. Moving on with the streets. So in the same section, dead-end streets are only allowed when they address topography or topography's constraints or in cluster subdivisions. Streets that serve 30 or more dwelling units or lots have to have a second means of egress. So this was the closest example I could find of Eaglewood Cove. You can see the one loop there where it essentially just has one means of egress. Now the fire code already says this, 30 or more lots, they have to have a second access. That's why there's not 30 or more lots in this particular phase on that require access off of that road, off of that loop street. But this was a good drawing to show you what I was talking about. When you have a single access that leads into a development that has more than 30 lots, there should be a second means of egress in case there were a fire and or an accident at that intersection that and it was blocked off, the people that still live there would have an outlet. Or if there was construction at that intersection, they would have an outlet to go somewhere else, so to get in and out of their subdivision. So that is the, I'm just putting that language in because it's the same as the fire code. Then also put in some guidance for street names. We don't want to have any more streets with eagle in them or wood in them. It's very confusing when they're very similar names, and so that's what we're trying to regulate there, is to stop having names that are so similar, whether they're similar to just in our city limits, but also in the neighboring surrounding areas that are in the same 911 service area. It could be very confusing to our emergency responders and delay response when we have names that are too close together. It also really confuses Amazon delivery drivers. They're very confused. They can't even find my up house, which I don't quite understand. And then clarify that, again, that the streets meet the same construction standards, that the private streets can require sidewalk only on one side. I don't know how you feel about that, but in this, in the Eaglewood Cove, we allowed that exception to have only sidewalks on one side because the lots were so large that that's a lot of infrastructure to put in and very infrequently used. And then the requirement is in there that we can require a traffic study if we feel it's warranted, if we feel like the traffic coming out of subdivision is going to have an effect on the connecting streets. Any questions on streets? Exciting stuff here. All right, the next section is on landscaping. This allows us to require landscaping on cuts and fills. So it goes without saying we already can require them to revegetate them, but this will put it in writing so that we have it where we can point to. It puts in things, that, again, that state things about preserving the existing landscape and the trees that are on the site wherever possible and practical. I put in a specific requirement that states that the landscapes in geohazard areas have to meet the recommendations on landscaping and water and water efficient land ordinance for the approved study. And then also specifically referencing the water efficient landscaping ordinance. And then on, I'm going to skip to the bottom. So in our current ordinance, we have in the subdivision ordinance, we have a statement about landscaping along Redwood Road where 24 feet behind the curb on the west side has to have a meandering path and 24 feet of landscaping. And it also, it says that along Redwood Road that you have to have a 6-foot side obscuring wall, masonry wall. As you remember when we went and did Morella, which is the photo that's on the top, they didn't want to put in a side obscuring wall, and frankly, I didn't want them to put in a side obscuring wall. The police chief didn't want them to put in a side obscuring wall because the police have lose visibility in the parking lot and can't see when things are going on. If there are vehicle or property thefts, it's a lot easier to discourage that when they're not hidden behind a wall. And so these are two examples on Redwood Road. The lower one has the masonry wall, which it's an attractive wall. It's not a bad looking wall, but right now our code says it's required. And so what I wanted to put that in there would say, instead of requiring it, that they may have that, or they may have a decorative metal fence with the masonry pillars or some other kind of decorative pillows like you see on Marilla. And as I was looking at that and moving that section of code into the new subdivision ordinance, I thought about Highway 89 and our town center and how we may have some more developments that happen along the corridor. And would we really want to have them put 6-foot side obscuring walls along Highway 89 and what the impact of that would be? And so I thought this might be a good opportunity to put in some language that says that for the landscaping along Highway 89, it has to meet the recommendations of the adopted cross sections for the town center, and that they couldn't have side obscuring walls, that it would have to be decorative metal fencing with pedestrian openings about every 150 feet so that people could access the trail and not have to walk a long distance if they live at one end or the other of the complex, to have to walk out of their way to get to the exit, to get onto the trail, to go the opposite direction that they might be going. So any thoughts, comments, concerns?
One comment. Oftentimes the fence can divert people to a safer crossing area than darting across Redwood Road if you can just come out at any place. Right. Does that seem to be something that would come into play, or is that just an urban legend that people will be less likely to go to the corners when they're not diverted that way from the fencing?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on where they're going. So, I mean, for Redwood Road, I don't know if there's a problem with people trying to cross. When I look at Morella, they only put one access at the south property line closest to Lee's. I don't know that anybody jets across there, but if you lived and you lived at the north end of the development and you wanted to go north on the trail, then you'd have to go south to the south corner and then back north. And so that was my thought, that it should be in more convenient locations and at least multiple locations. So I'm less concerned about the darting. I know it happens. So like one thing that happens down here on Highway 89 across from Eaglewood Lofts apartments, there is a bus stop that is further down from the light, and people do dart across that. If that bus stop was just located closer to the light, which it will be with BRT and with Williamsburg when they finally get their stuff together and start building, which I did talk to them the other day, so they're just still waiting on interest rates and construction costs, but they're still committed to build it. That would solve that problem of people darting across, because they would go up to the light because it's convenient. But going up to the light and then going further south when they get through the light, it can be tempting to some people to run the red light or to jaywalk. And I'll even admit to jaywalking when I leave City Hall sometimes and I'm walking through the middle of Center Street. But I'm very careful about it, and actually I stopped it because it was getting to take too long, so I just decided to walk down to the corner. Eventually I gave up on the jaywalking, my bad jaywalking habits. A mid-block crosswalk, yeah, just for me, not for anyone else. I sometimes still drive when it's cold or dark. But I have walked quite a bit this summer, so it's really nice. Anyway. Okay, the next section just deals with utilities and easements. It updates the language. Right now we have a requirement for 7.5-foot PUEs. That's just really weird. And so we'd like to round that up to 8 feet. And then update the code actually says the front public utility easement is 7.5 feet also, but we always require 10 feet on our front public utility easement. But we don't have that in the code, so we should get that in the code. And then there's a statement in there about requiring underground utilities even for existing overhead. This was not a subdivision. This is on 150 East. This was just a townhouse, but I thought it was a good picture that kind of show you the overhead utilities. If it had been a subdivision, we could have required them to bury those power lines down 150 East, which would have been really nice. But we didn't have that because it wasn't a subdivision. That stuff is already in the code. I just reworded it because it was kind of confusing, and I needed to put in the specific process for if somebody asked to be exempted from that requirement, how they would go about doing that. There's already the exemption in it right now that says the Planning Commission can waive it and recommend it to the City Council, but that was when in the previous ordinance, our current ordinance, is where all subdivisions would go to the council anyway. Now they won't all go to the council. So if we wanted to give them that exception, then it needs the process, so that would still have to go to the City Council for that exemption. Section 90 is a new section. It requires, for water courses, it requires a dedication of stream channels and drainage easements. And then section 100 and 110 are existing code. The section 100 is just about the dedication of streets and trails, how that's done. And section 110 is about solar and other energy access. I'm not really convinced that these are in the right chapter right now, and I'm not really understanding what the intent was of the solar energy stuff. So I wanted to meet with the city engineer and kind of go over these things in depth when I meet with her. Unless you have some comments or you have some questions about those sections that you want me to take back to her for clarification, because I was a little bit confused on that. I get the idea. I mean, you want to make sure people, if they want to put up solar arrays, but most people do it on their roofs now, and I'm not sure that why these ordinances were written back in the 80s and 90s. If there was a problem, there might have been a problem somewhere sometime when people were putting solar arrays in their yards and they might be blocked by neighboring houses. But now they're all roof mounted.
If we're done with that, can we just skip back to three things when I think of a subdivision I just want to ask about?
Yes.
Maybe there's some other section I didn't go searching for them, but when we were talking about the section on streets, and the example I'll use, I apologize if I use examples from things I observe, but I do.
No, that's
but like
most
in
helpful.
Bountiful City, you can be out riding your bike and you'll find intersections that have no traffic marks, there's no yield sign, there's no stop sign. So I'm not sure how they do that. I'm not saying it's prevalent, but it is. It has occurred. I have not noticed that in North Salt Lake, but where is that a function for the city engineer according to highway codes, or exactly how does that get decided?
So we do have standards in our standards and specifications for traffic control signs, but I think there should be a reference in here that the developer is responsible for traffic control signs and following the standards that are in the standard specification manual. So I think that's a good catch.
Yeah, and the other thing that I would add too, and it was particularly bad in the old unincorporated part of Davis County, like on Davis Boulevard, you can have some fence lines and you can have trees that have grown up that basically really intrude on sight lines on crossing some higher volume roads. And I think that somehow needs to be something that's not only done when the subdivision is maintained, but for the code enforcement officer, they maintain those sight lines because, you know, people may want to plop up a fence, or the next thing you know, this bush grew up that's blocking that. But that's a common as you go around South Davis. Again, I'm not going to say that I notice it so much in North Salt Lake.
And we do have other sections of code that regulate that, but I think that one of the things that probably should be addressed in the landscaping section or in the streets section, when they're planning for street trees, that they shouldn't put them in the clear view area or in areas where they will block traffic control signs, because that's where we've run into problems where we've had trees grow up and then Public Works has to come out and top the tree down because it is blocking a stop sign. And so if they just hadn't planted, if they had planted it right in the first place, and then that tree could have grown in the right place for 8 years, it would still be there. But unfortunately, that tree grew in the wrong place for 8 years and had to come out because it was now blocking the signs. So I think it is a good, that would be a good thing to address in the subdivision ordinance.
And just so you know, we already kind of are making steps towards that. Code enforcement, if they get a complaint, we'll go out and investigate. But we have land use permits for fences where whenever I get one of those, I'm checking the clear view. And then also land use permits for landscaping and retaining walls, which can be an issue for Clearview as well. So not a lot of residents know about it is the problem. And so they don't know that they can send it in and I can quality check where they're putting their trees and that kind of thing. Not saying I'm an expert.
Yeah, the other one is overgrown xeriscaping.
We're definitely working towards a solution, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. That sounds great. And then just two other quick things. The mailboxes. So I'm assuming in a new subdivision, Postal Service is requiring like a central location. So that's just in the
mailbox clusters,
easement or whatever. But should there be something that says something about mailbox placement?
Yep. I think there should be. Yep, I agree.
And then the last question, and I suspect this is elsewhere, is street lamp placement.
Yes. Very good. Those are definitely three really good catches. I will get those put in there. So that's why this takes a whole planning commission and a whole development review committee to review all this, because it's hard for me to think about all of these things. But those are three really good catches that I would like to put in.
Street lamp just sparked that apply to private roads as well?
Yes.
Can you indulge me just for a minute more, since I'm over participating already, and I'll just take it to an extreme degree. But anyway,
I love it.
I apologize. So in 13.8.10, the general standards, subsection F, there's this discussion about non-detrimental use. I didn't know what it meant.
I'm sorry, say that again.
13.8.10.
10.
Section F. I apologize, but I cannot, I didn't know what it meant.
Non-detrimental use.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny because there's a couple of places in here that the city manager said, hey, what about this language and what about that language? We need to have our city attorney review it. Because this is basically in our existing code, so it's language that we already have, but we're saying that, hey, you're going to do a subdivision, and it's not going to be detrimental to any of the people that surround you, and that's very subjective, and to think that we could say no to a subdivision because, in our opinion, it would be detrimental to the neighboring property owners. So I think that's probably something we should have the attorney check to see if that's language that we should take out.
Maybe make it a little clearer, because I really didn't understand what the intent was.
Yeah, and I think it was, you know, this is language that probably was written in the 70s and 80s when it was like all subdivisions are conditional uses, and if we feel like the subdivision that they're going to put in is going to have a negative effect on the surrounding neighbors, we could just say no to it. And that's probably why we have a lot of state codes that say, hey, a subdivision is an administrative decision, not a legislative one. And if they meet the minimum standards, you have to say yes to it. So that statement right there is a little bit soft and feel good.
No, other than that's a term that is used a lot and probably nobody ever understands what it means. I think they're given an out to the city to say,
no.
We can't tell you exactly why we don't want that subdivision. We're just going to call it.
We're just going to say it's non-detrimental. Yeah. It's detrimental. Yeah.
All right. And then a much more straightforward question. In one of the prior meetings, we were looking at, I think it was chapter 5, but anyway, we talked about the design standard for storm drainage facilities. And I think the standard that we talked, or that was in there now, was a 10-year recurrence interval, 10-year design basis. Is that what the city is sticking with? I know there was going to be some further discussion on that, or is that still to be determined?
So that is right now. Karen has done some revisions to it, but I wanted to sit down with her and go over it again because she didn't make very many changes, and so I needed to understand it more. So when I bring back the completed entire draft, then I'm going to go back and do a specific kind of like a little bullet list of here are all the things that we discussed and here's how we address them, and I'm tracking them. And so that's one that I still have the note in my draft copy for her to address, but I need her to educate me a little bit more on if she wants those numbers to stay, why. But I know that she did update some of them to deal with like the flood FEMA maps and things like that. But I think that's still something she might either be researching or she needs me to ask her again. That could be. But it will definitely be on my bullet point list, yeah, that one.
Yeah, I'm just curious if Commissioner Tucker has any insights on what he would expect. What would you think? You're a road guy.
And I'm just not educated enough on it that I could expand on it tonight for you. But I will certainly get an answer for you. That'll be at your December meeting when I bring everything back. I'll have a highlighted list of all of those changes and questions.
My final comment, I'll spare you the rest of it. But anyway, under that same section, that's the general design standards, 13.8.10, I still think there needs to be some further discussion about planning around private easements. And the case in point that comes to mind would be if it's for some major infrastructure like a gas transmission line or high voltage line or probably thing, and we do have those in these communities and development does occur. I actually had people buy a lot adjacent to that, and they were trying to build within the buildable footprint, but then they discovered all these terms and conditions and restrictions of these easements, and they were extremely upset and angry and felt like that they hadn't been told. They ended up turning around selling that lot, building over Olympus Cove, but it blindsided them. And I just think that the language in here ought to have something that acknowledges those and makes the buyers aware of the encumbrances, yeah, that can occur with these.
I wouldn't buy one.
It's the Kern River pipeline. Yeah. They're not going to let you just, you know, cut it down to the top of the pipeline, or they're not going to relocate their pipeline for you. They're not going to do a lot of
things. And you can't
build
anything over it, and you can only landscape on it.
The newer the right-of-way document is, the easement document, the more restrictive it is. Some of the old ones were undescribed and all that, but I do think there ought to be some language in here that talks about that occurrence, because I actually know from personal experience that that's been a big problem for somebody who bought a lot. And these were sophisticated people that own their own business and have their own attorneys and probably had all kinds of people look at this stuff, but somehow it became a real problem when it came time to build.
Yeah, I really do not like the lots that have the Kern River pipeline or the Rocky Mountain or Dominion pipeline through them. I really dread them. I know that that's kind of one of the main reasons when we looked at the ridge, that the majority of the lots the majority of the development where the pipeline goes through is actually in the open space. And so I think that's a good idea that we should probably say when they're developing around that those should be put in open space or common areas rather than into individual lots. Because I do think it leads people to mistakenly think, oh, I'm buying an acre lot, but they don't realize, and they may be paying a premium for that acre lot, but half of that lot is a pipeline through it that they can't do anything on. And so I agree with that, and I'll look at some language for that. Any other comments, thoughts? Corrections? Did you find any typos you want to give me? Besides Ron, I'm sure he found a few. Which I really appreciate. I'm not kidding, because I know by the time it gets to the council, Councilmember Baskin's going to rip it apart with commas and finding all of my typos. So I just soon find them now before it's before the council. So if you do find any of that, please send them to me at any time. And I'll still take them on anything that we've looked at and in previous meetings. So this is still very much a working document. But next time we will be looking at Chapter 9, the essential improvements chapter. So that kind of gets into the nitty-gritty of all that engineering fun stuff.
Thank you for all your work on this. Some of these things that have been in there since the 70s and 80s, because nobody wants to comb through it like this. So thank you for doing that and just elevating the whole document. It's
definitely been a project for sure.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
So we can move to agenda item 4, report on city council action items.
We haven't had any action items that have gone from the planning commission to the city council. It's been kind of quiet, which has been really nice for me, so I can work on this ordinance.
Yeah, you've had a lot going on.
So there are no action items to update.
Okay, great. And then
I will tell you, on a pending application, we will likely have a public hearing on November 14th on the 130 East project. So they have submitted version 4 to us, and we're going to have the DRC look at it next Monday. And so that may be coming to you for a new public hearing. Just to give you a little taste of it, they've reduced it down to 79 units. And
what was the last? Was it 98? Something?
I can't remember. 92, 93, somewhere in there.
Okay.
So it's down to 79. They shrunk the footprints of the buildings a little bit and cut down those units, added an outdoor seating area, patio for a possible restaurant.
Oh,
in
nice.
The retail space. So, but that will be coming. We'll get that advertised. So it should be a fun night in
Great.
3 weeks.
And that's how it works, right?
There
just
are
keep
three
going.
Weeks because there are five Tuesdays in October. Yay.
All right. And then approval of the minutes from October 10th. Any amendments to the minutes? Y'all good with the minutes? Does someone want to make a motion?
In the interest of time, Commissioner Jorgensen will make the motion that we approve the meeting minutes for October 10th, 2023 Planning Commission meeting as drafted.
Okay, and a second?
I'll second it.
And all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And we are adjourned.